From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the historical Jesus. We talk with biblical scholar and former priest John Dominic Crossan. He's written a controversial biography of Christ as a Jewish Mediterranean peasant who preached egalitarianism. Also today, as you brace yourself for April 15th, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele tell us how and why the middle class is being soaked by the current tax system. Their new book is America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a televised version of Verdi's fourth opera, I Lombardi, which airs on PBS tonight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has declared six Alabama counties federal disaster areas. They're eligible for federal disaster help. The state is trying to recover from tornadoes, flooding, and severe thunderstorms. Vice President Al Gore is touring Alabama along with James Lee Witt. Witt heads the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The emergency aid can include disaster housing, federal grants, and low-cost loans to cover uninsured property losses. The State Department is criticizing Israel in the shooting deaths of six Palestinians this week. They were killed Monday by Israeli troops in Gaza. State Department spokesman Mike McCurry says the United States wants Israel to prevent more incidents like this from happening again.
We've seen comments on this by the Israeli authorities who acknowledge that the crime or that the killings were a tragic mistake. And we clearly believe that these incidents should not have happened. We expect the Israeli authorities to take appropriate actions regarding this incident and to prevent further incidents of this type.
The Israeli army says the Palestinians were armed, but the army also says the Israeli soldiers fired first. Serbs and Croats in the breakaway Krajina region of Croatia have signed a ceasefire. The accord was brokered by the United States and Russia. Richard Carruthers reports.
Shortly before sunrise, after 18 hours of hard bargaining, the ceasefire was signed. Serbs and Croats had agreed on more than 30 maps which mark out their soldiers' positions and the distance they have to pull back. UN troops should then come between them while heavy weapons are withdrawn from firing range. Watching over the talks was U.S. Ambassador Peter Galbraith.
As with the agreement between Muslims and Croats, this step is important because it will save lives, but it will be most important if it leads to an enduring peace, and that's what we're working toward.
The next step is to discuss economic issues like the opening of roads and railways. Political questions on the status of Krajina will follow much later. Serbs there still insist they want an independent state, while Zagreb is determined to enforce its sovereignty over the land. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
Congressman William Natcher has died of heart failure. He was 84. Natcher, a Democrat from Kentucky, was famous for his unbroken string of votes in the House of Representatives. He'd served in the chamber for 40 years. Federal prosecutors say Cable News Network has violated a judge's order by airing jailhouse recordings of former Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega. The prosecutors say CNN has engaged in contempt of court. Attorneys for CNN say the broadcast did not violate the requirements of the judge's order. CNN has pleaded innocent to the charge, a trial set for July 11th. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials have plunged 61 points to 3,637. Trading is very heavy. This is NPR. The Department of Housing and Urban Development is hosting a two-day conference in Washington discussing ways to revitalize the nation's cities in terms of both housing and economic development. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
HUD Secretary Henry Cisneros called on community activists to work with his department on ideas like community policing, vouchers, and the move away from housing projects.
We know that it's not right that today we ask little children to come home from school and go into buildings where even the police dare not patrol because of the safety conditions in those buildings. The day has ended when we can isolate people in public housing from the rest of our communities. We must bring them together.
The secretary's remarks to the conference were interrupted at one point by a woman who works with the homeless in Washington, who shouted that they were being ignored at the conference. Cisneros defended the administration's record on the homeless.
We can't be held accountable for every mistake of the last decade or so in this first year.
The administration proposes to spend $1.5 billion on the homeless in the next fiscal year. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
Commerce Secretary Ron Brown has signed 4 agreements with the Russian government in Moscow. They're intended to strengthen American investment in the weak Russian economy. Brown says the accords will dramatically improve trade and investment between both nations. He says U.S. investment in Russia now totals about $1 billion, but he says that could jump to $50 billion under the new agreement. The French Defense Ministry says 10 French sailors have died aboard one of its nuclear submarines. The ministry has not explained the accident, but the government says it did not affect any nuclear machinery. A news conference is planned for today. The Defense Ministry says the submarine was able to return to the port of Toulon, which is about 400 miles southeast of Paris. It is also on the Mediterranean Sea. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sunday is Easter, the day Christians commemorate the resurrection of Jesus Christ after his crucifixion. My guest, John Dominic Crossan, is an expert on the historical Jesus. His new book is called Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography. He writes about Jesus as a man, a Mediterranean Jewish peasant who preached equality. Crossan uses the tools of anthropology, history, and literary criticism to reconstruct the life of Jesus. As you can guess, Crossan's work is controversial. Crossan is a professor of biblical studies at DePaul University in Chicago and a former priest. He co-founded the Jesus Seminar, a group of scholars who debate what Jesus really said and did. I ask Crossan what it means to look at Jesus historically.
The basic distinction, Terry, is between the canonical Jesus, which is the Jesus you'd get if you just read through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and get a general sense of who this person is. If you raise historical questions, you begin by asking, how come there's 4 Gospels if there was only 1 Jesus? Isn't that at least 3 too many? Why do you need 4 different accounts of 1 life? They raise for us the historical issue. They tell us, in a sense, that they are not simply giving us the facts. They're giving us good news, and they're quite open and honest about it, and I have no problem with that. But that raises for us the question, can we go back through those Gospels to see what we would have seen if we were there in the 20s of the first century?
Now, I think there are things that history really can't explain, only faith can. For example, the virgin birth. How do you examine that historically?
Let me take that as a very, very good example. As a historian, I'm looking at 2 texts now. There is a story in Suetonius, the pagan Roman historian, who tells us that the night that Augustus, the emperor at the time that Jesus was born, the night he was conceived, his mother Atzia went to the temple of Apollo, fell asleep during the service and stayed there overnight. And Apollo, the god Apollo, impregnated her, and the child conceived, of course, was Augustus, or later to be Augustus. And that same night, her husband Octavius dreamt that he saw the sun rising from his wife's womb. Now, that is a story. I then look over at the story in Luke, and I find Mary is overshadowed by the Holy Spirit, and in Matthew that the husband, Joseph, has a dream about the child to be born being the Savior. I have 2 stories. As a historian, I do not believe, I do not accept either of those as factual, actual, biological stories. I don't think either of them happened, if you could have been there, as it were, to have observed. But as a Christian, I am challenged to ask, in which of those stories do I find a dramatic visualization of God? Do I find God over on the Palatine Palace with power, with domination from the top down with the Emperor Augustus? Or do I find God in a peasant child born in a peasant stable, empowerment from the bottom upwards? And I have not the slightest hesitation in answering where I find God. I find God in Jesus, not Augustus. But that is an act of faith, not a statement of fact. If I was a Roman aristocrat, of course, I would be happy to find God glowing on Augustus. That's the difference between history and faith.
So,
and between story and history, too.
So in your faith, what do you make of the virgin birth? Do you see it as just a metaphor, or do you think that there was a miracle that happened?
The only word I would be nervous about is just a metaphor, because for me, metaphors are the...
Right.
I'm not picking on your words. Metaphors for me are what we live and die for. Metaphors are the ultimate meaning of life. They are our most profound interpretation. So yes, I do consider it a metaphor. No, I do not consider the biological statement about either Atzia or Mary. They are creedal statements of faith about where you find God.
Do you assume that Joseph was the father of Jesus, since you don't believe that, since you believe that the virgin birth is metaphor, not historical fact?
Yes, I would presume that Mary and Joseph, we know of six siblings, four brothers of Jesus and two sisters. They don't name them, so we only know there's plural, there could have been more. But Jesus was one of at least seven siblings. If the virgin birth is taken literally, then of course he had to be the firstborn. If not, then he could easily have been the youngest for all we know. So I consider we're dealing with a peasant family with seven children, and I presume that Mary and Joseph are the parents.
Now, what would you say to why the story of virgin birth developed?
Well, for example, that case I gave you from Suetonius is the clearest example to me. There's a certain in-your-face, Caesar, about it. If, after all, Caesar is claiming to be born of a human mother and a divine father, and that would not seem incredulous to the pagans, now we're claiming that our Jesus was born in the same way. The first pagan, Celsus, in the second century, when he criticized the virgin birth, never said, that's not believable, that's incredible, that's impossible. He knew that there was lots of stories like that. He said, God wouldn't bother with a peasant, in effect. Why would God bother with a peasant woman and having a son born of a peasant woman? It was the class that bothered him, not the miracle, if you will.
You know, a lot of people are afraid that if the historical authenticity of the Bible is questioned, if people ask, did it really happen? And if the answer is, well, no, it might not have, then people will have no faith, that Christianity will cease to mean anything as a religion. Do you worry about that, or do you think it's possible to have faith even if the faith isn't something literal?
I think it's going to be necessary because we are living increasingly in a multicultural world, and I don't say that just to be politically correct. I stand in front of the undergraduate class every September, and I can tell by the faces it's getting more and more multicultural. Underneath the multicultural layer is multicreedal layers. We are going to have to learn to live with other religions, and we cannot get away with claiming that our religion, let us say Christianity, has certain facts which never happened to any other religion. They have just myths or stories, but we have facts. That's not going to work anymore. We all base our lives on myth, the Christians just as much as everyone else.
Did you always feel that way?
I don't think so. No, I think when I started studying, I pretty much took, you know, what I'd been told as fact, and I didn't really ask the type of question I'm asking now. It took years of study, and as soon as you take the four Gospels and start to read them in parallel columns and compare them with one another, and realize that one is copied from the other, you cannot help but ask these questions. So the questions are inevitable. You can close the door to them, ignore them, and sort of retire into a closet, but the questions are there, whether you want them answered or not.
Easter, which is coming up, is celebrated as the day of Christ's resurrection. Let's talk a little bit about crucifixion. This was a pretty common punishment in the time of Jesus. What was it punishment for? What kinds of people were crucified?
If you knew that Jesus had been crucified and knew nothing else about him, you'd know two things immediately. First of all, that he was lower class. And secondly, that this was some form of what was seen as subversion against the Roman order. It was not done to the upper classes, and it was not done probably just for a petty criminal or a petty robber. It was really state terrorism. It was intended to terrorize people so they would not do the same thing. So you were, in a way, hung out for everyone to see. And part of the terror of crucifixion, and part of what made it one of the three Roman supreme penalties, like being tossed to the beast, being burned alive, or being crucified, was that very often there was nothing left to bury. That's what made it a supreme penalty. It wasn't calculated simply as being more painful because the Romans never bothered about such things. It was that it was public, it was humiliating, and above all, you would be left on the cross for the crows and the dogs and the wild animals. There might be nothing left to bury, and that was what was terrible about it.
What do you make of the resurrection?
The resurrection, means for me that the power of God, which was present in Jesus, but confined, say, to Lower Galilee or Judea and to those people who could come in immediate contact with him, is now available to anyone, anywhere in the world, who wishes to find God in Jesus, who believes that God is available in Jesus. It has nothing to do, as far as I am concerned, literally, with a body coming out of the tomb or a tomb being found empty or visions or anything else. All of those are dramatic ways of expressing it. What is the heart of resurrection for me is the experience that the power of God is now available through Jesus, untrammeled, unconfined by time or space. That is for me the essence of resurrection.
But what would explain the disappearance of the body?
I don't know if we have to explain the disappearance of the body, because that presumes that we are taking the stories that we have there literally.
Mm-hmm.
What I understood happened, this is my historical reconstruction, the disciples fled, and they said they fled. I do not think they knew anything beyond the bare facts that Jesus was taken, Jesus was crucified. I don't think they were there. I don't think they were watching. I don't think the women were there watching, because the only one who tells us about the women is Mark, and Mark tells us about the women in order to show that they really did not believe. They came to anoint Jesus, even though he had told them that he was going to rise from the dead. So that I don't think any of the first followers of Jesus knew what had happened. They had fled. And their most terrible thought, their most awful thought, was that maybe nobody had buried him. And it's hard for us to realize how terrible that was in the ancient world. It's much more terrible even than it would be for us to be left unburied, unmourned, sort of annihilated your identity as a human being. Now, the only hope would be maybe some pious Jewish person might have buried Jesus. But then by the time you get to John's account, you have a full, beautiful, magnificent, royal anointing. Pounds of precious ointment, a garden tomb, than which you could not imagine a more perfect burial. I cannot take those as factual accounts because of their differences and because of their inherent apologetic trend to get Jesus properly buried. I don't think the first Christians knew what happened to the body of Jesus.
My guest is John Dominic Crossan, a professor of biblical studies at DePaul University. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the historical Jesus with John Dominic Crossan, author of Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography. I'm sure you have great admiration for Gandhi and for Martin Luther King. These are figures who we revere for the work that they did. But it's different than the relationship a Christian has with Jesus. Jesus is a figure of worship, not just a historical figure that you respect enormously for the sacrifices that he made. Where does it come in for you that Jesus is worthy of religious reverence and not just, you know, the kind of historical respect we pay to our greatest and most enlightened leaders?
I am not at all certain, Terry, that if a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King had not been in the right place at the right time, which simply wasn't where they were, that they might not be so revered as such figures, because to say that somebody is divine means that I, as a believer, whoever this believer is, find God in this person. It's an act of faith. If enough Christians had not found God in Jesus, then Jesus would not be divine for me. It's an interactive relationship between God, this person, and a believer. So if, for example, millions of Hindus had begun to find, say, Gandhi as an incarnation of Krishna, then he would have been an incarnation of Krishna, and he could have become the incarnation of Krishna. There is no way that you and I could say that could not have happened, and had it happened, it would have been true.
So your historical research has not shaken your faith?
No. What it has helped me is to distinguish between an act of faith and a statement of fact.
And
that is very important to know the difference.
Tell us what the difference is to you and how that affects how you live your life.
Well, for example, if I were to take, we talked about the virgin birth a couple of times, supposing I were to say, no, that is a fact. It's a biological fact. It would be ascertainable if, for example, we had medical examinations possible at the time. Then you're saying that faith is in facts, and I do not believe faith is ever in a fact. If I said to you, I don't believe in America, you would know immediately. I'm not saying I don't believe there's landmass between Canada and Mexico. You'd know I must be saying I don't believe in America as the land of opportunity, the land of the free and the home of the brave, as the place of the future, whatever. Somehow it would be a way of seeing America. It would not be the fact of America. It would be the interpretation of America. So an act of faith, for me, is always an interpretation. It is really a fundamental interpretation. And it's necessary to know the difference between a fact, which should be available to anyone who has the available methods of checking it, and an interpretation, which may not be able to be proved or disproved, especially if it's an act of faith, which is fundamental interpretation.
You used to be a priest. You resigned from the priesthood in 1969.
Right.
How come you left the clergy?
Two reasons. One was I wanted to get married, which is a good reason all by itself. The other reason was I was in constant trouble I'd been taught to think critically, and every time I did it, I was in trouble. So even if they had told me you can get married now and stay a priest, I would have left in any case. So there was two motives, really, Terry: getting married and being able to do my own work without being in constant trouble.
So you have more freedom as a scholar than you did as a priest?
Definitely. I mean, and I recognize that. As a priest, in a way, you're both, it's hard to criticize with a collar on, and I understood that, and I thought I would be better in university. I got dispensed. I asked for permission to leave the priesthood, and that was granted to me, so I thought it would be better. I would work in a university, and then I would not confuse people by wearing a collar and saying critical things.
You write that to remove that which is radically subversive, socially revolutionary, and politically dangerous from Jesus' actions is to leave his life meaningless and his death inexplicable.
Thank you. That was a nice sentence. I've forgotten that one. Yes, I mean, Jesus was put to death by the authorities, and the Romans may have abused power, but they didn't waste it. So he did something that really bothered them. And to make it sound like he was a nice little kid going around, a nice person going around and patting little babies on the head and telling sweet little stories, and some inexplicable way they managed to kill him, it makes no sense of anything. What he was doing was socially subversive in the first century and probably in the 20th century. I don't know how we'd get him today, but we'd get him somehow. We'd either trivialize him or we would destroy him.
I imagine a lot of people are very upset, angry with you for saying that the Bible is not meant to be read literally but metaphorically.
My mail, which is interesting, is running about even. I expected a lot of people to disagree with me, obviously, although we've already started when we began to question the creation story, when we opened the Bible and find that the world was created in 6 days and one day of rest. We've already started on this slope of asking this question, so we can't stop it. But what has surprised me very much is the number of letters I've got saying, in effect, thank you. We find it nice that we don't have to park our brains outside the church in the morning. We find it nice, this is my summary, we find it nice we don't have to mortgage either our conscience or our intelligence to be Christians. I do get almost even letters positive, and that is very surprising because usually it's the negative you get and you never get the positive.
So with Easter coming up, tell me what Easter means to you.
I cannot separate the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. I wouldn't just put all the emphasis on the death as if the life was not important. The death is, first of all, connected to the life. The life that Jesus was living as a social revolutionary, the only question in your mind was, when will they get him and where? Will it be Antipas in Galilee, or will it be Pilate down in Judea? So you're waiting, in a way, for something to happen. The death makes sense against that background. It is not that Jesus goes out looking to get himself killed, but if anyone does what Jesus does, They have to be ready to die. So I put the death along with the life. Then what is extraordinary is that instead of ending it there, which is what they hoped to do, it continued. If no Christian had ever written anything for the first 100 years after Jesus' death, we would have Josephus the Jewish historian and Tacitus the pagan Roman historian telling us three things. There was a movement over there in Judea. We officially executed its founder, but it continued. Josephus says those who loved him before continued to love him afterwards. Tacitus says with a marvelous sneer on his face, the disease broke out again and spread all the way to Rome, where everything rotten comes eventually. Now, those three things, movement, execution, continuation, those are the raw data of history that can be seen from an outsider. That really is, from an outsider, what Easter is about. From the insider, then, it's up to them to explain, in their own language, how come they still believe in Jesus, even though he was put to death, even though he was executed. And that belief is the resurrection.
In other words, that belief is what keeps Jesus alive.
That's what keeps Jesus alive. Put in the simplest language, nobody believes Jesus is dead and gone forever. And that could have happened in the first century. That is why I have tremendous, tremendous awe for the faith of the first Christians, and I don't like to see it trivialized as if they had a terrible day on Friday and then it was all solved by Sunday afternoon. Sunday afternoon, Easter Sunday, is the condensation, as it were, of 3, 4, 5, I don't know how many years of anguish, agony, and faith.
Will you be in church on Sunday?
Will I be in church on Sunday? No.
You won't be?
No. When I left the priesthood in 69, I really had two choices. I'd been in a religious order and spending, you know, maybe 5 hours of every day in church. I sort of prorated that over the rest of my life and figured I was ahead. But I think what I had to do seriously was I really had to stay away from the hierarchy of the church, or I was going to get trapped in negativity, spend my life opposing them. And so I really decided, okay, I'm going to be a scholar. And to be honest with you, I don't think I know the difference between prayer and study at this stage. The only way God gets at me is when I study. That's what changes me. Prayer doesn't work for me in that sense. If prayer, by the way, means letting God change you rather than telling God what's going on. So I find, no, I don't need it. I'm better off without it because I just get mad. I'd be annoyed at the sermons. I'd be annoyed at this. I'd be annoyed at that. And I'd be spending my life trapped in their program. I don't find myself in the least bit angry, by the way, at anyone. I moved out of the priesthood into the university and I've been particularly happy. And so I'm not doing it because I'm mad, but the price of staying not mad is to stay away from the hierarchy, but stay close to the tradition. I feel very, very close to the Catholic tradition, and I probably could no more not be a Catholic than I could not be Irish. I mean, I could change the documentation, you know, but it wouldn't change me. So in that sense, no, I deliberately find it better to stay away from the official church.
John Dominic Crossan is a professor of biblical studies at DePaul University and author of Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As you prepare your tax returns, do you suspect that you're being taxed at a higher rate than a lot of millionaires? You're probably right, according to a new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Coming up, they tell us why. They have a new book called America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? Tonight, Luciano Pavarotti stars in a PBS version of Verdi's fourth opera, I Lombardi. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Reports from South Africa indicate there could be a resolution of the struggle for control of Natal Province and the KwaZulu homeland, NPR Suni Khaled reports.
South Africa's Transitional Executive Council is expected to announce a state of emergency in the province of Natal, KwaZulu, where nearly 300 people have been killed this month in political violence. A decision could come as early as next week when the TEC meets on Tuesday. The body, which is preparing South Africa for its first all-race elections, has already made preparations for a state of emergency, and army troops are already being deployed in Natal, KwaZulu. The measure is seen by many as the only way to ensure the holding of free and fair elections in the province. However, Inkatha Freedom Party leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi has warned of a bloodbath if a state of emergency is declared. Inkatha is boycotting the voting, and its leaders claim South Africa's new constitution will lead to the domination of the Zulu people by the rival African National Congress, which is expected to win next month's elections. I'm Suni Khaled in Johannesburg.
Reports from Cairo indicate Israel and the PLO have reached an agreement on Palestinian security. PLO sources have told the Associated Press both sides have agreed that 100 Palestinian police officers will guard Hebron in the West Bank. That's the town where 30 Arab worshippers were murdered by an extremist Jewish settler a month ago. Both sides are still working out the number of foreign observers that would be permitted into the occupied territories. A transformer explosion in northern New Jersey briefly knocked out power to 50,000 residents and caused lights to dim throughout New York metropolitan area. Steve Inskeep of member station WBGO reports from Newark.
The blast took place at a utility substation in Jersey City, and it was so intense that it briefly sucked power out of much of the surrounding area, causing a dip in the lights several miles away in Newark and New York City. Inside the substation, three utility workers who were repairing a piece of equipment near the site of the blast suffered burns and other injuries. They are listed in very serious condition after being brought by helicopter from the Penhorn substation to University Hospital in Newark. Several more people suffered minor injuries after a fire that knocked out power to thousands of residents and knocked several radio stations off the air. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in Newark, New Jersey.
The government says orders for factory goods fell in February for the first time in 7 months. The drop of 1% was triggered by a decline in orders for commercial aircraft and parts. The drop is concentrated entirely in aircraft. The government says shipments of finished products actually rose in February. On Wall Street, stock prices have plunged again today. The Dow fell for the fifth straight session. The industrials lost 72 points to close at 3,626. This is NPR. Kentucky Democrat William Natcher, a member of Congress since 1953, died last night of heart failure. Natcher was 84 years old. He holds the record for the most consecutive votes ever cast. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
House Speaker Tom Foley said today while Natcher will most likely be remembered for his unbroken string of more than 18,000 votes, he should more appropriately be remembered for his legislative achievements. Natcher represented his rural district since he won a special election in 1953. He drove himself each day to work, paid every dime of his campaign costs himself, and was not heavily reliant on staff. He won 20 elections by wide margins, the old-fashioned way. He preferred handshaking to paid advertisements. As a member and eventually chairman of the powerful Appropriations Committee, Natcher won numerous federal projects for his district. In a statement released today, President Clinton said he hopes Natcher's devotion to public service inspires young people for as long as his voting record stands. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The White House has released papers detailing Hillary Rodham Clinton's investments in the cattle futures markets in the late 70s. Contrary to a report in this week's edition of Newsweek, the papers show she used only her own money to invest. The magazine has backed down from its story after one of its sources said it was misleading. An editor said the magazine will apologize if the White House could prove Mrs. Clinton used her own money. Mrs. Clinton turned a $1,000 investment into nearly $100,000 within a year in a bullish cattle market. Heavy fighting is reported in two Bosnian towns. Battles are raging around Garajda and Bihać. Both are Muslim enclaves. Bosnian government radio says a heavy Serbian artillery attack began at midnight local time. Observers say it's in revenge for a recent offensive by the Bosnian government. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. As you write out your check to the IRS, consider this. You're not the only one who thinks they're paying too much. Today's tax system is skewed heavily in favor of the privileged, and the middle class is getting soaked, according to a new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele. They're investigative reporters with the Philadelphia Inquirer and co-authors of the bestseller America, What Went Wrong. In their new book, America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? Bartlett and Steele say we presumably have a progressive tax system, a tax built on the belief that as income rises, so should the rate at which it is taxed. But our system isn't nearly as progressive as it used to be. In fact, if you have a feeling that you're paying taxes at a higher rate than a lot of millionaires, you're probably right. Between 1971 and 91, according to Bartlett and Steele, the combined Social Security and income taxes paid by the average family in America shot up by 329%. By contrast, the combined tax bills of millionaires declined 34%.
In terms of total dollars, the people at the top pay the largest amount because they have the most dollars. But what we're talking about is how much money a family or an individual has left over after they pay those taxes. And when you look at it in those terms, middle America is being hammered as never before in this century. And to go back even further, if you go back to the 1950s and you look at the federal income tax, Social Security tax, and state and local income taxes, there weren't many states or local governments that had those at the time. Philadelphia did. But if you look at just those four taxes, the average family paid about 10% of its earnings in those taxes. You come forward to today, and that figure is 24%. And that doesn't include real estate taxes, local and state sales taxes, excise taxes, personal property taxes, per capita taxes. So the average family is up there around 30%, maybe even more in some cases, of their money going to pay these taxes, leaving them less for, you know, rent, just the ordinary things, food, clothing. And also the other important aspect of this is when you go back to the 1950s, that income was earned basically by one person. Today it requires two working spouses to have that median family income.
Is there a particular income bracket that you think is paying a particularly disproportionate share of taxes?
Sure. It's anywhere up to about $75,000.
But what's happened also in this country, years ago when you had a true progressive tax system, people who made $100,000 paid at a lower rate really than somebody making $200,000, and on up the ladder it went. But basically anymore, everybody from about $250,000 on up is paying in the same category as someone who might be making $5 or $10 or $15 or $20 million a year. That's what's substantially different than the past.
Yeah, and then when everybody feels that they have an unfair tax burden that they're being asked to bear, then it's particularly easy for politicians to play on those feelings and make promises that they're maybe not even going to keep, or they're going to end up hurting us anyways in the long run.
That's precisely right, and that's what you see going on time and time again. One of the most fascinating things to us when we went back and looked at this whole issue of taxes, every time there's a tax debate, every time there's a tax bill, the same language comes out from the halls of Congress about what's going to happen. They say things like this: we're going to tax the rich. We're going to make sure companies pay their fair share. We're going to give the middle class a break. We're going to take care of the poor. We're going to close loopholes. All of this rhetoric comes out each time that happens. But each time they don't close all the loopholes. They don't apply that tax across the board. Inequities abound, but it's the process by which they try to assure everybody that everything's okay. You pay your fair share because we're doing the best we can to make sure we take care of the system. It's part of that reassuring salve to make sure basically the middle class people just simply don't rebel.
Why do we keep hearing the same rhetoric about easing the burden on the middle class when that never seems to exactly happen?
This gets down to the part that's what people want to hear. And that's what politicians want to give them. And that's part of that reassuring salve that keeps the system working. By the time it is apparent to people that that hasn't happened, another tax bill is coming down the line, which applies many of those same principles. Part of it is the complexity of taxes. Part of it is that people just simply don't know how to follow that issue. But part of it is the process to keep the system operating. Washington's greatest fear really is of a genuine tax revolt among people across the country who are very upset about what's happening, because that would destroy the entire system. The system is based largely on voluntary compliance, the fact that people believe enough people are paying their fair share, and therefore they will pay theirs. If enough people don't believe that, then the whole system collapses because the IRS simply couldn't keep up with the kind of avoidance that would then ensue.
What about the 1993 budget? Did that ease the burden on the middle class as Bill Clinton promised he
would
try to do?
That was a very modest increase on upper income groups, and that was basically the extent of that. It's working a little bit in terms of dealing with some of the deficit problems, but it is amazing in retrospect the kind of rhetoric that you saw about that bill at the time. You had people at the top who were complaining in Congress about that relatively small increase on people at the very top level. They said, this is class warfare. One of the most interesting things we came up with in searching this book, you go back through tax legislation in history, every time they're trying to raise rates at the top, they call that class warfare. But every time they want to cut rates at the top, the bill is invariably called tax reform.
My guests are journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele, authors of the new book, America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about inequities in the tax system with investigative reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele. I want to clarify something with you. Often when people are very frustrated about the amount of taxes that they have to pay and the little amount of money that they're left with, their solution is, well, I don't want to pay this anymore. Let's cut the welfare program. Let's do away with special programs for the poor and for single mothers. And, I don't have the money to support that stuff. So what kind of answer do you give to people on that who are genuinely frustrated by the tax bills and just want to, like, you know, stop supporting social programs?
This is another great case in which Congress feeds this too, because, again, lawmakers in both parties play to that constituency, and it is really irresponsible. And you can put this in really very simple terms. The biggest expense out there, it's not food stamps, it's not welfare, it's the interest on the national debt.
So you're saying that we're not being soaked to support social service programs? No, that's not really
that's
what most of our taxes
right.
are going to.
In fact, there's one.
So are you saying cutting back those programs isn't the solution to cutting back our taxes?
Well, if you want to cut spending, eliminate that deficit. Don't trim it. Eliminate it. You eliminate it with a progressive income tax.
And how would that help?
You
raise more revenue. And obviously spending has got to be cut too in certain areas. I mean, you just can't keep spending money.
Alone since 86 from the Tax Reform Act of 86 to the nation's wealthiest families will total at the end of this year $200 billion alone, just in that one small group since 1986.
You mean the nation's wealthiest families are paying $200 billion
less as a result of that act.
Mm-hmm.
As Everett Dirksen used to say, this is real money.
So your solution to the national debt would be to increase taxes on the truly very wealthy.
That would be one solution.
One solution.
That's part of it.
That,
I mean, you need a whole range of things, but that certainly is one factor.
Since we're talking about progressive taxes and the fairness of the tax system, Ross Perot was talking about taxes during the last presidential campaign. I believe you looked into his tax records. How much did he pay?
Well, you know, we don't know how much he paid overall, but we do know, based on the financial disclosure statement, that he had somewhere between $18 million and roughly $87 million in income that was tax-free, no tax paid.
These are tax-exempt securities.
Tax-exempt securities.
Bonds issued by state and local governments. And in that sense, he's not...
There's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, this is perfectly legitimate.
And he's by no means unusual.
Nor is
you
he
have,
unusual.
You have many, many wealthy people investing in that, and it also goes to the heart of that 86 debate where they made such a point how they closed all loopholes. They left the biggest one, the longest-running one, the most sacred of the loopholes for the very wealthy, intact. You have roughly $44, $45 billion a year in interest income from those bonds that goes untaxed, and that overwhelmingly flows to the richest families in this country.
You say that America has two tax systems, one for the rich and powerful and one for everybody else. I think you've illustrated several of the ways, several of the things that led you to that conclusion. Are there other inequities you see in individual taxes that have led you to that conclusion?
Oh, they abound. There are so many here. I'm not sure. The one thing you can be sure of is if you're an ordinary person, you're not going to get your own tax law. Only very special people get those, but they do get them. They get the tax laws, especially tailor-made for very wealthy people or people with influence. Jim and I, for really light entertainment, read the Internal Revenue Code, and it's you know, that's why we're considered weird, I think. When you read the code, it's really terrible language, but you go for a few pages, and then you'll find a paragraph that will just jump out at you, and you say, wow, what is this? And just listen to these words. Special rule for beneficiary of a trust. In the case of an individual who is a beneficiary of a trust which was established on December 7th, 1979, under the laws of a foreign jurisdiction and who was not a citizen or resident of the United States on the date the trust was established. This goes on for several paragraphs, and basically what it does is excuse that person from paying taxes that everyone else in this country must pay. And they do it, Congress does it, by not naming the person, but by saying a person who's a beneficiary of a trust established on December 7th, 1979. Now, somewhere out there is one person who meets that criteria and who does not have to pay taxes.
We'd like to actually make a personal appeal to any of your listeners. If any of them are out there who knows who this particular person is or is the person and would like to stand up and take credit for this remarkable tax break, we will assure them that they will get some publicity because this is one of the great ones in the code. And we pride ourselves on being able to decipher these things, but this is one on which we've failed, and we'd like to clear our record up on that.
And we did write to every member of the Ways and Means Committee, House Ways and Means Committee, every member of the Senate Finance Committee, and invited them to identify this person, but they, for some reason, all refused. And the typical response came from Richard Gephardt, who's been a longtime member of the Ways and Means Committee. He said, in response to your specific question relating to the identity of the unnamed individual who will benefit from a transition rule, special rule for beneficiary of trust, my office had no involvement in this matter. And that's our Congress at work.
It's tax time. I don't know if you've done your taxes yet or not, but this is the time when everybody has a personal decision to make. Are they going to do their best to, if not exactly cheat, to use the benefit of the doubt in their favor at every opportunity they can?
This is a growing problem with filing tax returns for a whole range of reasons. And really at the heart of it, too, and the reason the whole system is getting more and more out of control in some ways, is the complexity of the system is getting of such a mind-numbing quality that many people feel, even if they did fudge a little bit, that they probably won't be caught. And there's a certain amount of truth in that, unfortunately, which goes back to another one of these bits of the rhetoric that you see coming out of Congress every time they pass tax legislation. Every time there's a big tax bill, they say that they are simplifying the tax code.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And that goes to the heart. And the reason they say that, because they know everybody is so frustrated by this system,
yeah.
How complex it is, how difficult it is to maneuver, how hard it is to decipher many of the parts of it. And the complexity grows with each year. And it benefits, unfortunately, a very small number of people, and it benefits largely a tax industry centered in Washington. Has to do with tax lawyers, has to do with tax lobbyists, it has to do with this whole hidden shadow government that deals with the regulations, deals with the kinds of provisions that Don just read there on the foreign trust that apply to tiny numbers of people. But that system thrives under the kind of blanket of secrecy that works because of this complexity.
So what personal philosophy do you take at tax time? Do you try to keep to the letter of the law, or do you try to use the benefit of the doubt in your favor so you could pay a little bit less?
We have a very modest proposal that would actually solve this complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And
get you off the hook.
No. If you go to Washington at this time of the year, and you go into the Capitol, you can see this. IRS sends its people up to Capitol Hill this time every year, and they have an office in which they do the tax returns of members of Congress, both the House and Senate, because they obviously can't do their own tax returns even though they write the laws. So our proposal is that Congress enact the law that makes it mandatory for every member of Congress and every executive branch appointed official to do their own tax returns, and in fact makes it a criminal offense if they get advice from a tax accountant or tax lawyer. And we feel very strongly if this law is enacted, the tax code really will be simplified.
Donald Bartlett and James Steele are investigative reporters with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Their new book is America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? They'll be back with us tomorrow to discuss tax inequities in the business world. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. What do you have, Noah?
Hi, Terry. Arguments in the Supreme Court today, a case involving a special public school district for disabled Hasidic Jewish children. Nina Totenberg has that story. In other news, in Mexico, a second suspect is being held in connection with last week's political assassination. Richard Harris has the story of a discovery by a paleontologist, a complete human skull, 3 million years old, uncovered in Ethiopia. And I'll talk with the owner of Ted the Rooster in a small Kentucky town. Ted the Rooster predicted the outcome of sporting events, picking winners at an 85% accuracy rate, it's claimed. Ted died on Monday. His son, Teddy, will try to take over.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight, most PBS stations will be showing a pre-recorded performance of Verdi's fourth opera, I Lombardi, in its Metropolitan Opera Presents series. It stars Luciano Pavarotti and bass Samuel Raimi. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says they're not the only good things in this opera.
Stars like Luciano Pavarotti can sell tickets to just about anything. That's why this year, the Metropolitan Opera mounted for him its first production of one of Verdi's most obscure operas, an opera I never thought I'd live to see. It's an epic extravaganza called I Lombardi alla Prima Crociata, the Lombards at the First Crusade. It's not exactly a great opera. Verdi was still trying his wings. It has what might be the most absurd plot in all of opera, which is no mean feat. In the first act, the heroine, Giselda, is in Milan. In the second act, without any explanation, she's a prisoner in a Syrian harem. In the third act, she runs off with her heathen lover, Orante, who is sung by Pavarotti in one of his strongest recent performances. Orante is fatally wounded by the Christian invaders, but he's baptized at the last moment by a hermit who lives in a nearby cave outside of Jerusalem. the hermit also happens to be Giselda's uncle, who's still doing penance for murdering his father, Giselda's grandfather, by mistake. The trio for Giselda, the dying Orante, and the hermit is one of the great things in Italian opera. It's 12 minutes long, with an extended solo violin obbligato and harp accompaniment. It prefigures such other great Verdi ensembles as the quartet from Rigoletto, because its soaring melodies express the distinct feelings of its three very different characters. That's Met Concertmaster Raymond Jevic on the violin, Pavarotti, bass Samuel Ramey, and soprano Lauren Flanagan. The Met has had its share of soprano troubles lately, what with firing Kathleen Battle and Aprile Milo canceling her appearances in the role of Giselda. Flanagan looks like an operatic Maureen O'Hara. Unfortunately, her basically pretty, light voice caves in at the bottom and scrunches up at the top. Her high notes are rarely up to pitch. She's not really ready for Verdi, and the Met should not have made her an offer she couldn't refuse. On the other hand, the Met chorus is marvelous, and James Levine has turned the Met Orchestra into one of our national treasures. The staging, with people rushing around waving gigantic flags and a giant crucifix descending from the rafters, probably isn't as effective on TV as in the opera house. Given the current world situation, one could easily be offended by a story in which the heroes are trying to eradicate Muslims from the Middle East. The Crusades are one of history's more dubious enterprises in the name of religion. But the libretto is so absurd, it's hard to take either the good guys or the bad guys as anything but generic. On that level, I Lombardi is great fun, and the youthful exuberance, sincerity, and occasional sublimity of Verdi's score makes it even more than that.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. I Lombardi airs tonight on most PBS stations. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Greenlease and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Donald Johanson is the paleoanthropologist who discovered Lucy, the oldest partial skeleton of our erect walking human ancestors. On the next Fresh Air, Johanson tells us about his new discovery, a nearly complete skull 3 to 4 million years old. Also, more on the inequities of our tax system. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.